You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
This year, Doctors Without Borders, also known as Médecins Sans Frontières or MSF, will celebrate its 40th anniversary as an independent humanitarian organization. But since in order to do its work, MSF sometimes is forced to make concessions with local governing authorities, some of its members have questioned just how independent the NGO really is. MSF has now made these internal debates over the ethics of humanitarian aid public with the release of a book called Humanitarian Negotiations Revealed, The MSF Experience. Michael Newman co-edited it with Claire Magon and Fabrice Weissman. He has worked on MSF missions in places like West Africa and the Balkans, and he's currently the research director of CRASH, the Center for Reflection on Humanitarian Aid and Knowledge. The book is published by Columbia University Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Michael Newman to our show today. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon, Leonard.
So where did the idea for this book come from? Aren't you airing your dirty laundry in public here?
We are, but I think it was a necessary exercise for working environment that is not very used to that. You know, there's a lot of myth surrounding humanitarian enterprise, and I think it was an important endeavor to release some of the not so much dirty little secrets, but let's say the recipes that we have to use to cook our operations. You know, and as you rightly said, the type of negotiation that we have to enter into with powers in order to conduct our line of work.
Because your work is often done in places where there's conflict and also where there are governments that we don't approve of?
Pretty much so, but I think one of the conclusions of the book is that we don't operate in a vacuum. We do have actually to confront powers, whether they are like local authorities, village chiefs, or international organizations, and in that you know engagement with them, there are a number of compromises that need to be made in, you know, the type of population that we have to work that we want to work with, needs that we need to address, the activities we conduct, our public communication, the security of our staff. All those elements depend very much on our relationship with the powers and authorities.
So when do you start reflecting on these moral gray areas of a typical mission? During the mission or after people come back and talk about what happened?
Pretty much all the time. What happened is that in the past few years, there have been a number of incidents that MSF has been facing or involved with. You know, I've been suffering a number of murders of our head workers in Afghanistan, in Somalia, even pretty much recently, you know, at the end of 2011, abductions or pressures by authorities on our work and public communication. And in all those cases, you know, there was a growing tendency in MSF and outside in the general aid community to explain that our space, our humanitarian space was shrinking, that, you know, it was getting more and more difficult to work. And that is a little preposterous, I think, to say that, because there has never been such a golden age, you know, for humanitarian aid. I mean, difficulties have been part of that work forever. We had staff kidnapped in Somalia in the late 80s, and I think that we are confronted to this situation on a very regular basis, and so constantly we need to engage internally, you know, in these discussions.
So the perception that it's gotten more dangerous recently, there was a golden age where everybody welcomed the NGOs in because they appreciated the help. That is a myth?
That is surely a myth. I mean, there's no denying in the book or when I speak that, you know, organizations like ours is facing, you know, difficulties in Somalia or in Sudan or in Afghanistan, and that there's been a spike in incidents, you know, in some of these countries over the past few years. But one should also acknowledge that there's been a tremendous growth, you know, in the overall budget of the humanitarian assistance, you know, which, you know, was multiplied by 10 in the space of 20 years. The number of aid workers also, you know, increased. by many, many folds in the past few years. So incidents are a reality, but, you know, the conclusion that, you know, that some says, you know, that the space is shrinking is definitely, you know, not as simple as that.
When did you join MSF?
That was in 1999, actually, my first experience was working in the Balkans alongside the Kosovar refugees in Montenegro and Macedonia.
Had you worked as a doctor in France before that?
Actually, I'm not myself a doctor. I'm working as a, as you said, as a researcher. My background actually is on political science and history. You know, our listeners should know that about one third of whole MSF head workers are non-medical.
Did anything happen during that time in Kosovo that alerted you to the kinds of obstacles that would affect your work at MSF?
You know, actually, it's very interesting because when you enter in such, like, let's say, a career, I did not expect the type of questioning that I would be facing and the tough choices, you know, that you sometimes have to make. In particular, you know, I remember this second mission of mine. You know, it was in South Sudan, in Akwem, in a small place where there is virtually like no health care available for people. And we had to negotiate an agreement with the local authority. You know, it was the rebellion, the SPLA, Sudanese rebellion. And they wanted to impose on us like pretty harsh conditions on staff recruitment, the payment of taxes. They wanted to monitor our radio communication, all those elements that we wanted to resist strongly. But when facing, you know, the population who were victims of malaria, of tuberculosis, of malnutrition. Yes, there was. We asked ourselves, you know, for a few days, for weeks, whether we should actually sign that agreement, and we did because we thought it was the right thing to do.
Well, is there a level of concession and compromise that is just too far for you to go? Do you draw the line on certain things? Because you, in this book, we learn about many painful decisions that some people might judge rather harshly.
Yes, there is such a line. Although the line is never, you know, it's not a concrete line. It's a line that evolves with situation that has to be examined on a case by case basis. And there is no one size fits all approach to any of those questions that you've asked. There is no like flashing red light that would like, you know, like help you answer those questions. But there have been instances where, you know, we have had to pull out when facing such situation. Like recently, and you know, you may have heard about that
in Libya.
In Libya, absolutely.
There are prisons in Libya that you pulled out of.
You know, the MSF had been working in detention centers since August last year. And we took the painful decision to leave that part of the project after realizing that, you know, we were basically helping the authorities to put back on their feet prisoners between like torture sessions.
So you were making them fit for further interrogation.
Absolutely, you know, and so it took a while for us to realize that. That's probably, I mean, I was not involved in the discussion, but I do assume that it's a case that's pretty much clear cut. It's not often, you know, it's not often that case. But sometimes you have to realize that you'll find the resources in your political and moral judgment, you know, not in your medical expertise. There are, you know, instances where when you realize that actually you're helping the tormentors more than the population, then you've reached a point where abstention is the best choice.
If you've ever wondered what goes on behind the scenes in humanitarian negotiations, Doctors Without Borders has revealed the sometimes dirty truth in a new book. And I am speaking with Mikhail Newman about this very topic. The book points out that MSF does work in certain countries that other humanitarian groups refuse to to operate in, such as Burma, Myanmar. Is it up to each organization to provide a standard for itself?
I think it is, to the point that one need to make sure that our line of work is about saving lives. If we don't save lives, then there is no point, you know, working in any of these of places that are complicated to work in. You know, we mentioned Burma. We could have talked about Eritrea or North Korea or Libya, as we have just mentioned. Burma is an interesting example, just also because there was so much controversy inside the organization about whether we should actually develop activities in a authoritarian state.
Well, are you working within the Burmese area, or are you working with the rebel groups that are engaging in a civil war with the government?
Well, for pretty much long, actually, we've been engaging on the border areas where the rebel groups fight the government. That's originally where we wanted to work. We let ourselves being drawn into working in the field of public health, you know, and treating HIV/AIDS patients, treating patients with malaria.
But you're doing the work that many governments should be doing for themselves and for their own people, making it easier for repressive regimes to spend the money other ways, like on their military.
That's a good question. But then you have to consider, you know, like in Burma today, I think we treat 21,000 patients with HIV, you know, providing above 200,000 consultations of malaria affected patients. Would the government do anything? Should we be not there? The answer is probably no. I think it would be wrong to expect, or probably a wrong judgment to expect the Burmese authority, let's say like 10 years ago, when
because
this whole program
started. They're moving toward a more democratic approach. At least it looks like they're softening.
Yeah, time will tell. There are reforms. It's a little early for us to tell how much we're going to be able to expand further our programs in regions that have been out of our reach. We've been making a lot of concessions and compromises in Burma, you know, not being able to work in all the regions we wanted. But I think despite all that, we should be pretty proud about what we've achieved.
Has MSF ever been kicked out of a country as a direct result of the work it was doing? For example, the Islamist group Al-Shabaab recently banned the International Committee of the Red Cross from operating in Somalia for allegedly handing out expired food rations. But the ICRC had already suspended much of its aid in the country due to obstruction by armed groups like Al-Shabaab.
Yeah, we've been expelled. I mean, the history of MSF is full of episodes like that one, you know, from Ethiopia in 1985 to the more recent Darfur example in 2009. We are still operating in Somalia, both in the TFG, I mean, in the areas that are held by the interim government, and in the areas that are under the control of the Shabaab. Our operations are constrained for security reasons due to the imposition by the Shabaab of conditions to our work. We're not able to work with international workers, for instance, and that is a problem. Again, that is the type of problem that we weigh against the impact of our operations today and the expectation that we have that hopefully, you know, we are effective. What's going to be, you know, the next steps of the Shabaab toward the AID community, I cannot say, but it's true that in the past couple of months, they've been pretty harsh on the AID community as a whole.
My guest is Michael Newman, who is one of the editors and contributor to a book called Humanitarian Negotiations Revealed, The MSF Experience. It's published by Columbia University Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. The My guest is Mika Newman, who is one of the editors, along with Claire Majon and Fabrice Weissman, of a book called Humanitarian Negotiations Revealed, The MSF Experience. It is published by Columbia University Press. And in it, there are a number of essays, 12 essays, is it?
Yeah. I mean, there are several parts to the book. There's a first part with stories about, you know, MSF experiences in the field of negotiating and making compromises in different situations. And then there's a second part that tells about, like, let's say, longer stories of MSF and the evolution of MSF in different fields, the field of conflict, public health, and natural disasters.
Well, some of those stories that where you had to deal with complicated situations, I guess any objective observer would... his heart would go out to you. For example, there was the one that took place in the refugee internment camps in Sri Lanka in 2009, or what happened in Pakistan following the earthquake in 2005. This complete chaos, and humanitarian aid workers have to make major decisions on the ground, trust that they're making the right kinds of decisions, despite the fact that they're being asked to do things that they might not really feel very good about.
Yeah, and you know, that's why we are not, like, throwing away humanitarian principles of, like, independence and neutrality and impartiality, but we have to collectively acknowledge that these principles are no magic keys, you know, to opening any doors, and that there has to be some level of compromises to those principles. You mentioned Pakistan; it's an interesting example. You know, I think never before had we been led to work in some kind of cooperation with the military, you know, which was much better equipped to rescue the victims of the earthquake, and we're basically just somehow helping them or supporting them. A military that we are having huge trouble with working in other parts of the country in completely different contexts. You know, so I think that
because the military in Pakistan seems to have conflicting goals anyway.
Absolutely.
And so they apply to you as well?
One has to understand the different logics of the different various actors that do evolve with time, that are not also homogeneous. And, you know, a government is not a body only. It's also a series of people who make, like, rational or irrational choices that you have to adapt to.
Including you call foregoing freedom of speech. That occurred in Sri Lanka when MSF was allowed to set up a refugee hospital on the condition that the workers not report what they saw there. In Yemen, where the workers decided to say nothing about bombings in 2009, since they determined that it wouldn't accomplish anything.
Yeah, and let me tell you that you're here entering a minefield. I mean, there's, like, so many discussions within the organization about whether their choices were the right one, you know. MSF likes to think of itself as an organization that speaks out, you know, when facing mass crimes or, you know, violence. And what we witnessed, you know, in the past few years is the growing reluctance of the organization to speak out. That there are explanations to that, carefulness. I think there have been, like, more and more evidence that the MSF speeches could be used to mount military interventions, for instance, and that the consequences of those military interventions could be extremely detrimental to the population, you know, like in Bosnia or in Somalia. And so we are getting much and more and more shy, you know, vis-a-vis that speaking out.
Well, you also find yourself in odd situations. France was a major supporter of the overthrow of Gaddafi, and now MSF has to leave Libya because the liberators of the country are torturing the former supporters of the man who tortured them.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, acknowledging that MSF did not support the intervention, nor actually did we judge it illegitimate. We actually did not say much about the intervention outside of a few individuals within the organization. But for that very, very reason, I mean, it's, you know, taking a stance on a military intervention is something that we rather not do.
The first of your articles in this collection is about something that happened in South Africa. Were you involved in the mission?
No, I was not. I was not. That was in the early 2000s at the time that I was in the Balkans and in Sudan. South Africa is a wonderful experience. It's a positive one, actually, with some limitation, but it's a positive example showing that not only we don't work in a political vacuum, but also we have to create alliances to work efficiently and to save lives.
Well, this is an HIV/AIDS story, and the leader of South Africa at the time, Thabo Mbeki, was denying that AIDS was caused by the HIV virus.
You know, there were so many constraints that we were up against in that place where, like, you know, the prevalence of HIV was very high amongst pregnant women and kids and men. And you rightly say that the political authorities were in denial, in total denial. The pharmaceutical companies were setting prices that were extremely high for antiretroviral drugs. We had a head community of donors were basically saying that the African wouldn't be able to take the drugs because they had no watches. There were like so many ridiculous, you know, environments that we had to resist. And together, you know, with the civil society groups, with patient groups, with academia, with local authorities, we were able, like, you know, to build some kind of alliances of consortium who gradually managed to make a breakthrough. But
also political opponents of the government. Doesn't that cause trouble?
Also, but I think, you know, it was pretty
You're
clever.
Getting involved in the internal politics of a country.
We are, and I'm not saying, and I think, you know, too many people pretend that humanitarian action is beyond and above politics, you know, that it should be, like, stay away that, like, dirty world of politics. But de facto, we are in there, you know, and we have to, you know, ally ourselves with people for some time. Those alliances, they have to be revocable. I mean, but yes, for sure. If our independence, you know, would you imagine MSF being able to launch a program such as the one that was launched in South Africa in the early 2000s on its own, you know, an organization of white doctors from Europe in post-apartheid South Africa, without the help of, like, the, you know, some a civil society that was low, that was so lively, so vivid. There was no chance, and I think the risk was really worth taking, looking at where we are right now.
MSF, called Doctors Without Borders in English-speaking countries, sends doctors all around the world to tackle problems that are as varied as the countries and cultures they go to. I'm speaking with Michael Newman, who is one of the editors of a new book called Humanitarian Negotiations Revealed, the MSF Experience. It's published by Columbia University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, talking about other countries. But the other article you contributed had to do with MSF getting involved in political activism in your home country, France.
Yes, absolutely. There are.
I thought France had a great healthcare system.
We do. It's holes, probably like yours, and it's,
I don't know. I always thought if I get sick, I want to get sick in France because
maybe not so if you were undocumented migrants, you know, and being pushed to the margins of the society by authorities who'd rather have not. In the country at all, and there is something that I'm very happy about MSF. You know, it's that it is somehow against any type of policies of domination. Societies produce their share of sacrificed people or of marginal people, and that happens even in France. And I think that we need to be engaged alongside any of those groups. Plus, in addition, I think that we have, or let's say that I feel myself as a French citizen, that I do have a particular responsibility towards my country and the way it treats the population that is living on its soil.
So what was the reaction of the French government to what you were doing?
They are super happy, I think, and that's the problem.
They were happy.
I think, and that's the weird position we are in France today, and in some other places, you know. We are, and you said so, I mean, we are providing care that that authorities should be providing otherwise, and France has the means to do so. What's lacking is the political will, and my guess is that, my analysis is that they're pretty happy to see, you know, private head groups doing the work they should be doing. And I think it's very important. And, you know, the purpose of that article was actually to inform MSF on the dangers of their position in France, you know, being like so not confrontational with the French authorities and basically doing their work, the government work.
MSF's initial advocacy involvement was reserved to action directly related to healthcare, such as providing legal support to people deprived of medical services and helping to draft the universal healthcare coverage law. When did it start to involve itself in issues beyond medicine, like working against asylum policies for refugees?
I think we never really got out of public health policies. When we look at the asylum status of people, it's always related to their ability to access health care. What we've seen in the past few years in France is a dynamic by the authorities to reduce access to healthcare for undocumented migrants, asylum seekers, people who are, you know, who've got like to pay for care, whose access to the liberal medical sector is getting more and more difficult.
Has this caused a division within MSF? Are there purists who say we should just be practicing medicine?
It has, sure. I mean, the mission in France has actually been heavily debated as well and discussed alongside that line that you've just discussed, but also because some people are denying that very asylum crisis that I've described. So plus a few others are just saying that we have no place to work in France, that you know, there are more needs in Malawi and more people are dying in Somalia today, and you know, this is not our place.
William in Manhattan left this question. How does MSF obtain the medicines it administers to patients in impoverished and war-torn countries? I imagine that can be quite expensive.
It is. I mean, we actually obtain them thanks to the support of, you know, mostly private donors. And we actually have, you know, throughout MSF history of like now 40 years, we have learned to work with quality drugs and have mounted a system of supply of quality.
Several of the stories in the book are kind of shocking and dealing with medical malpractice. For example, there were these questionable surgeries and unnecessary amputations of Pakistanis who had been injured in the earthquake in 2005, and there were fake vaccines administered in 1995 by the Nigerian government that was supposed to help cure a meningitis outbreak. What can you do? You can't put the legs back on. Can you engage in court actions?
What we can do is make as sure as possible as that the care we provide is of quality. I mean, none of the case that you mentioned involved MSF operations, nor the ones in Pakistan or the Nigeria case with the fake vaccines. But that's also the quality of care. That's also an area in which we have to compromise. The Somalia example is again a perfect example in a pretty painful one. We've been engaged in Somalia for many, many years, but without the presence, as I said earlier, of much international presence. And as you can imagine, like finding skilled doctors is pretty difficult. So when we set up a surgical project in Mogadishu, for instance, we have to live with the fact that the standards of care are not those that we would like them to be.
Yeah, journalists aren't allowed in Syria right now. Are MSF doctors allowed in?
No, we're not. We are trying to help the Syrian population in any ways. It's extremely difficult for the whole aid community. I mean, we are getting the reports, you know, about clinics being attacked, about doctors being attacked by the authorities. But our ability actually to work in that area to provide assistance has been extremely, extremely limited.
Is this book the first time a record of these kinds of struggles has been brought to the public's attention? Has any other NGO ever done anything like this?
I think so. MSF has actually itself published a number of books in the past in a series called like Populations in Danger, and this book is the last in this collection. But this book is also the first that MSF, where MSF deals with its own relations with authorities. And I don't think that there's been any other example of such, let's say, openness about the nitty-gritty of the work we do.
And the French title really is more revealing than the English language title. It's Acting at Any Price? ?
Yeah, and I think the answer is no. But the tough part of the questioning comes. I mean, where do you draw the line, you know? And that's what we are exploring in this book. There is never any, you know, hardly any clear-cut cases. It's a lot of reflection that needs to be done in situation by the field workers, by headquarters workers, by us analysts, you know, to help the decision making to be accurate. We have to. I think the head community has to acknowledge that we can make mistakes. And that the do no harm approach is a nice horizon, but it's unrealistic. We do some harm. The question is, how much harm do we do? And the bottom line is to make sure that we do not do too much harm.
Mikhail Newman is one of the contributors and one of the editors to a book. The English language version is called Humanitarian Negotiations Reveal, the MSF Experience. It's published by Columbia University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Leonard. That was a pleasure.